I'd like to thank the ladies who have brought this beautiful spirit into this chapel this evening. Their music is beautiful, and it has virtually invited our Heavenly Father to be with us this evening in a beautiful manner. Our topic for today was, Surely Goodness and Mercy Shall Follow Me. I'm a believer that God blesses us with testimonies that we are responsible to share and assist our fellow men in the many trials that we have in this life. Tonight I would like to share with you two testimonies that God blessed me, which I think the 23rd Psalms epitomizes. Both testimonies involve leaps of faith in God's power. The first, I was a Zions League leader in the 70s and 80s in Center Stake. The president of the Zions League at that time had decided to enlist 40 youth and 6 leaders to travel for 3 weeks in the British Isles, witnessing and conducting vacation Bible schools and youth services. It's a leap of faith is when you leave your comfort zone and trust in our Heavenly Father to guide us. And that first big leap of faith for me was going to a country that I had never been to before. They drove in a manner that I wasn't used to driving. And that was probably the biggest concern to me, was to land at that large airport, Heathrow Airport, and be in charge of a van load of youth and to get them safely to our first night in London. So I was coming out of the Heathrow Airport, and they have turnarounds in England a lot. And so I came out of there, and I saw all the other cars going in different directions into the different roads. And I just kept circling for just a couple more times till I made sure that I had the right place I was needing to go, and that I didn't go into oncoming traffic, or that I didn't go onto the wrong road and get lost from the rest of the group. And so that was my first challenge on day one in England. Then we went together as a group. We stayed in London, and we put on services in London. And then we divided up, and one leader went with 6 youth, and we went to the different cities in England. Well, the city that I got responsibility to lead the services was in Leicester, England. Now, I had no knowledge of Leicester, England before I was assigned that. I had never been there, and I knew no history of Leicester, England. But we went there. I met the pastor, Norman Norton, and we visited the church that they worshiped at, and it was beautiful. They kept it, the grounds, beautiful roses. And so our responsibility that week was to put on vacation Bible school for the for that town. So on Sunday, we put on the service at that congregation. The youth did. And on Monday was the first day of our Bible school. And Leicester's a big city. It's, I'm going to say equivalent to probably, it's not as big as New York or Chicago, but probably a lot bigger than Kansas City. We went to the church at the time assigned for vacation Bible school, and we had the seven of us from the United States and about five or six of the church members who were going to teach the classes. And we had one child show up for vacation Bible school. And they were fully prepared, had the refreshments, had everything ready, great expectations, but there was no youth. And so we sat there for a little bit, gave them a little bit of time to come, thinking they might be running a little bit late, and nobody showed up. So, not knowing what was proper to do in another country like that, but knowing that we needed to do something if we're going to help these people, I divided each one of the senior high from the United States to go with a leader or an adult from the Leicester congregation and go door to door and knock and invite them to come for the Tuesday service. So each one of the youth, we departed from the church all by walking, not by cars or anything. And I assumed the pastor would assign me an adult to go with me to show me where I was going and everything. And he assigned me about a 15-year-old gentleman. And he told him, you know, introduce John and get him acquainted to the people in these particular area that we were going to be inviting people. Well, I expected him to have his time for us to warm up to him and to break the ice. And the first house we came up to, he walked up, knocked at the door. And the lady came to the door, and he said, "This is John from America," and then disappeared behind me. And I thought, what do I tell? I mean, these people did not look receptive, and so I did not know. I didn't see any kids in that house. I did not know what to do to try to. Get them to see if they had any grandchildren, any children that might want to come. But I did. I invited them. We went from house to house. And we pretty much got a cold shoulder from everybody that we knocked at their doors and invited. And so knowing that we didn't get any response from the people in that neighborhood, there was a group of youth who were following us as we went around. And there was me in a suit, and this Bible right here was what I had that gave me the confidence and the determination to just keep holding on tight to it and bearing my testimony to some of these people. But they weren't receptive, so the youth that were following us was the only people who had any desire at all to be around us. And I asked the gentleman who was helping me, I said, you know, should we talk to these youth? And he said, oh no, these are the bad kids. These are the kids that nobody has anything to do with. So I went up and asked him. I said, would you like to come to church? You know, we had this little church one block away. Would you like to come down and be a part of our vacation Bible school? These youth all laughed. They said, oh, we don't believe in that. We don't go to church. You know, we'll have nothing to do with that. So they were playing marbles. And so I said, well, you know what? I said, I'm the marble champion from the United States. And I tell you what, I'll play in a game of marbles. And if you beat me, you don't have to come to church or anything. But if I beat you, then you'll come to church. And if you beat me, you'll take my title as the USA marble champion. Now, I hadn't played marbles in 15 years, so I was taking a leap of faith. But I had my Bible and I had God. So we started, we divided the marbles up, and me and the ringleader, which was the toughest boy that was there at the in that group. And there was, it was approximately 20 kids that had followed us by the end of the, all the door knocking at the very end of those cobblestone streets. So the ringleader, he divided the marbles up, and he gave me mine. And we started shooting. And by the time we were down to the end of the game, we each had one left. So I thought, boy, this is going to be a big, big loss if I lose this one, because I don't know how they were doing in the other communities, but from our community, we didn't have any people coming. So it was my shot, and I shot. And I hit it, took his marble. So I said, okay. I said, I won this game now. I want to see you there tomorrow. And the 15-year-old boy who took me around said, they are not going to come tomorrow. These are bad kids. They will be gone now. And so I said, well, that's all we can do, you know. So we showed up the next morning, Tuesday. And it was the same people there that was on Monday. The teachers, the food, the youth from the United States, and the one youth there for Bible school. And then all of a sudden, here come these 20 kids. And these boys kept their word. And they came, took part in the Vacation Bible School, and in Leicester, England, that was the largest Vacation Bible School they had ever had. So I know if we take a leap of faith, God will bless us. God will lead us, and God's power will be with us. The next, the next leap of faith and a testimony that I'd like to share to you tonight is a testimony he gave me 5 years ago. It was in July of 2012. And I'm a, you know, from working with youth work so much and bearing your testimony and praying, I like testimonies in my sermons because those are proof of God working in our lives and how He has touched not only us but others. In July of 2012, I had experienced two bouts with kidney stones. I felt like I was coming down with another kidney stone, and I had the first experience with the first kidney stone. It was painful, but it wasn't unbearable. The second one was a nightmare. It was very painful, and it was a very bad experience. But I couldn't put it off any longer, and I thought, well, I'm going to leave work and go by Center Point and have them check me out in the emergency room, just see where the stone is at, how far it's traveled down. So I went up to the emergency room. They gave me tests for 5.5 hours, and the doctor came back out. And he says, well, I've got good news for you. You don't have a kidney stone. And he said, the bad news is you have stage 4 pancreatic cancer. Now, I was clueless to what pancreatic cancer was. I had no idea. My wife was with me, and she was from the medical field, so I could see tears coming down her face. She knew that stage 4 pancreatic cancer was terminal, and I didn't. I knew it was bad because the emergency room doctor who took care of me walked us to the car. And I had never seen a doctor cry. But she walked us to the car and set it up for the next morning to go see a cardiologist. So the next morning I went and met with the senior oncologist, who explained to me that there was two options. The type of pancreatic cancer you have, and what he suggested was that I start taking morphine, and in 30 days, the pain would all be gone. The other option, which he didn't suggest, was that I take chemo, I take radiation, and I have the most painful surgery in the world. Now, I was 60 at the time, and I had my parents, who you see over here today, and my wife, 7 children, 25 grandchildren. The easy way would have been to take that morphine. The doctor said that living and beating stage 4 cancer was not an option. He said 3% of all pancreatic cancer patients live only 5 years. After chemo and radiation and the surgery. My biggest concern was what would happen to my family. The pain that they would have to go through. My next concern was I didn't want my grandchildren to learn to give up easy and to be a quitter. I was happy with my relationship with God. I trusted God. I knew that the place I would be going to would be a much better place. And I was mentally prepared to meet my Maker. My good friend Bob Baker was diagnosed with the exact same diagnosis, stage 4 pancreatic cancer, a few weeks before me. And he went through the first round of chemo and called it quits because the pain was more than he wanted to tolerate. It made him very sick. And he decided to quit it and go on the morphine. And he passed away in 4 weeks. I started mentally preparing myself by talking to God daily for guidance and strength and how to prepare my family. I had my family praying for me. My South Chrysler church family was praying for me. And I have friends in Mexico, and they had hundreds of people in Mexico praying for me. I was treated with 2 months of chemo and radiation before the surgery. My oncologist wanted me to gain enough weight so that I could, he wanted me to weigh 300 pounds before I had the surgery. And when I was diagnosed, I weighed 275. And I got to 299. Couldn't make 300, but I got to 299. And I couldn't figure out why he wanted me to weigh 300 pounds. And that's because after you have this type of surgery, they take off half your stomach, half your intestines, all your gallbladder, and half of your pancreas. And with this surgery, you're going to lose weight and never going to be able to put it back on. So we went ahead and I called out two brothers from South Chrysler to come out and administer to me the day before the surgery. Steve Smith and Steve Ruoff. And I remember being in pre-op wondering if I would make it through the surgery or if I just, when they put me asleep, if I would just stay asleep. Since I was not given any good news throughout the whole ordeal. It's an experience that I will always remember of possibly saying goodbye in that pre-op to all my family and friends for the last time in this world. I woke up in post-op and in tremendous pain. At one time I wondered if I was alive or if I was dead, because the medication makes you a little confused. And so I didn't know if I was in the next world or if I was still in this world or what. But the nurse came by, so I know I was in this world, and she was coming by checking things. And she asked me how I was feeling. And I said, I'm burning up. I said, I am on fire. And he says, well, you've had a major surgery, and that area where you're feeling the pain is exactly where he cut. And so I said, yeah, but don't you have any medicine you can give me for it? And he says, you're getting the most powerful painkiller in the world, Dilaudin. And he says, you can't be in any pain. I said, ma'am, I am burning up. It feels like a blowtorch. So she went away to the next patients, and about 15 minutes, maybe 20, she came back by and says, now, how do you feel now? And I said, I want you to put me to sleep, do whatever you have to do so I don't have to, I can't take this any longer. I said, it's just more than I can handle. And she rolled me over, and as she rolled me over, she gasped. The feeding tube for the Dilaudin was pinched and was twisted. So coming right out of surgery, I was getting no pain medication at all. And I heard her say to another person in the post-op, I don't see how he didn't have a massive heart attack from that pain level that he had to experience. I knew God and his angels were with me and protecting me. The doctor asked me after I came out of post-op, he gave me about a month. Because that was in the first week of November. And the first week in January, you know, he had told me, you know, my clock was about 11 months. So I knew, you know, I knew it was coming still. So, but he asked me, do you want to take more chemo? And I had to think about that because I had liquid chemo and he was switching me to chemo pills. And chemo pills were a lot more painful than that. But I said, yeah, I'll start taking the pills. And I took the pills for about 4 months. And after about 4 months, I got to the point of the side effects that I thought, well, you know, I'm just going to put it in the hands of the Lord. And if he has another job for me to do, if he has another place for me to go, then so be it. Then that's what I'll do. So I stopped taking the chemo pills in April. In June, my oncologist called me back in, and that's about month 11. And he's a happy, he was an Indian gentleman, very, one of the most respected oncologists in the city. And so he's always stood up and shaking my hand every time he came in the room with a smile on his face. So this time he came into the room. I stood up, put my hand out, and he didn't shake my hand. Then I looked at his face, and tears were running down his face. So I thought the worst. I thought this must be it. He's going to tell me. After looking at my blood test and all the different CAT scans you have to take, he's going to tell me, you know, I'm to that point now where they're going to put me on the morphine. He hadn't shaken my hand yet, so he walked up to me, put his arms around me, gave me a big hug, and whispered in my ear, it said, "You beat it, you're cancer free." Said, "But I don't want you to tell anybody that I healed you and cured you of this." He said, "Only God can cure you of stage 4 pancreatic cancer." A few months later, I was in my den, and I prayed to God, asking him why he saved me. Because I had to see Bob Baker's wife and kids at church, and I thought, you know, he could have saved us both. And an audible voice filled the entire room of my den and said, "Because I want you to tell my people that God is alive and still performing miracles." I took God's instructions very seriously, and I spoke in church services. I spoke in front of the City of Independence at their Martin Luther King celebration, which is well attended. And it's opened doors of being healed of the pancreatic cancer. It's opened so many doors to help people who come down with cancer and give up. You don't have to give up. It gave me the knowledge to tell them to tell your church family, tell your family, tell whoever you want to pray for me and uphold me to God. And one gentleman that I counseled with, he was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, and he had 3 little children. And I said, you know, how are you with God? And he goes, "Well, I believe in God." He said, "I'm good with God." I said, "Do you go to church every Sunday?" He says, "No, we don't go to church." And I said, "Well, you're good with God. What's going to happen to your wife and your children? Don't you think going to church would be a good support system for them?" And we talked in my office for a while. And then he left, started going to church. He died of the pancreatic cancer, though. God didn't save him from it, but his children. He had the peace of mind of knowing that his children and his wife were with people who were like family. It is my hope and prayer that you will share God's testimonies that he has given you, that he has blessed you with. Because in this world, there are a lot of God's children who are lost and in need of God's Spirit in their lives.